This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Anne Bracken is here with an exciting array of poems. Let's hear an opening poem, Anne.
Inner Compass. It could rain anything during the night. Leaves, or maybe you dream of anyone speaking a riddle that you can answer. In what language does a cardinal call? I yearn for time not designed by techie gurus who bring endless yet useless updates to you. None of them will keep you alive until your imagination is free to understand that too many things feel small because a cramped vision is useless for the world that calls to you.
Anne Bracken, what I love most about your writing is that you're always reaching with innovation to get the best possible story. So tell us a little bit about how that poem was put together.
Well, the poem is in the form of a golden shovel where you take a line from a poet, a line that you love, and then the last word of all of your lines, when you read it down, reads the poet's line. So the line that I chose is from David White's poem, Sweet Darkness. And it goes, anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you.
So each one of those words in David White's poem is the end of each one of your lines.
Yes.
So if people want to hear more about that, they better go to you. And they
yes.
can find a website, AnneBrackenAuthor.
Yes.
.com. Because
right.
It's quite fascinating. That's what I like. You are really afraid of nothing. And there's something about the way you take risks that gives me such an inspiration. Give us another example of a poem.
Okay. This is a poem called Insight that I wrote just recently. Insight. Soothe your ragged fears with the promise of time to correct the wrongs in your past. Lie down under the pine branches in the middle of your yard and fulfill your dreams in this exuberant loneliness, knotting together all the hobbies for which no one has paid you, create new rituals for the endless procession of time. How could you have known that all those days alone were nothing more than a rehearsal?
Now, is this a form that you have derived from some one of your magic potions?
Well, I actually took a class with a poet named Chad Frame, and he suggested that if we were puzzling over finalizing a poem, that we take it and translate it into another language and then translate it back to English.
What was the change?
Several words were changed, and the way some of the lines were put together was changed. And I took some of the changes and others I discarded.
Well, did you think it made it better?
Yes, I liked it. I liked some of the new phrasing.
Was it because of the randomness of it or the way that you didn't expect the words to fall? What made one better than the original?
Well, I think at least one of the word choices was not a word I had chosen, and I translated the English poem to German, and then from German back to English again, and one of the words was translated as exuberant, which I really liked.
I see. That's a great thing. I understand now. So that all of us can take a poem that is kind of iffy, we're just not quite set with it, and put it into our Google Translator, into a language. It'd be fun to do Japanese, say, then do
yes.
it again into English and see how they provide different synonyms for that.
Right.
Oh, I'm going to do it. Anne Bracken is here. She is an educator. She was trained in speech therapy and pathology, and she still incorporates that knowledge of the human voice in her own work. She has two books of poetry, No Barking in the Hallways, and The Altar of Innocence, which we'll hear about later. And she's had poetry and essays in many anthologies and journals. She is a working poet. And I mean that in the greatest sense of the word. She will set the alarm clock to wake up to write poetry. This is called being a disciple to the art. Take us somewhere else, Anne, with another poem.
Okay. This one is called Tapestry. Sometimes you tire of the weaving and unweaving, threads tangled and unruly as you create the tapestry of your life. The husband and the babies no longer a fantasy. But what are you to make of the frayed strands of love that no longer bind you to the man you sleep beside? No one warned you that life could turn into a midnight sideshow once you discovered yourself in love with someone new. Both of you chameleons, blending into your reluctant routines, happiness teasing you in a divided mirror.
Mm. What a powerful, painful, true work that is.
Thank you.
And is there a secret to the creation of that poem?
Yes, that poem I worked with a tool that Taylor Molly designed called Metaphor Dice.
Metaphor Dice.
And yes, Metaphor Dice. And there are three die, a red, a white, and a blue, and you have a noun and an adjective and then another noun. And they make unusual metaphors. So the two metaphors that I chose to work into the poem were Midnight Sideshow and Divided Mirror.
So you would not have put those two together if the dice hadn't shown up that way?
I don't think so.
So you roll the dice, I mean, figuratively, you roll the dice.
Yes.
And the way the subject, noun, and adjective come up is you can decide whether or not you like it.
Yes, exactly.
But it is unexpected. What do we have to say about the randomness of art and how that is better than the lockstep thought? I mean, scholarship ridicules art for this because scholarship only believes in the tractable and in the observable. But what is it that makes the spirit so much more alive when the unexpected happens? Talk about surprise a minute. Your work is full of surprise.
I think that that's what, you know, that's how I get into the place where I want to write a poem. It's almost like finding a current in a stream and surrounding yourself with some kind of beauty in the place where you write. Or, you know, a lot of times I'll write in my dining room where I can look out at the trees and the flowers. And that seems to be the kind of space that allows me to bring forth any kind of work.
So place, environment, atmosphere, you start there. And then
yes.
You never make a soup without the ingredients. That's what I want to point out to everyone about you. You really can't work without the tools. So you've come with images, you've come with fragments, you've come with a process. And therefore, if we all do that, we wouldn't have to be so afraid, I think, of that blank page.
Right. Well, I think sometimes you just have to recognize that everybody fears the blank page. And you just have to open up that space and say, it's okay. Whatever I write today is okay.
Do you think, and you have taught on every level of education, including college and graduate work, do you think that your teaching in some way used these processes?
Well, I do think so, because basically one of the most necessary tools for a teacher is to go with the flow and to read the class.
Mm.
So you may walk in with a lesson plan, but the energy might be someplace else.
Hmm.
That you kind of pick up from the things that the students are saying, and hopefully you have enough tools in your toolbox that you can go with that energy.
Good point.
And move in another direction.
Good point. Anne Bracken's poetry and essays and interviews have been in many magazines and journals: Little Patuxent Review, Gargoyle, Meepiosis, New Verse News, Gyroscope, many, many. And she is also co-chair of the Wild Readings Poetry Series in Columbia, Maryland. Is that monthly, Anne?
Yes, we read every month from September to June. And because of the current COVID crisis, we're doing our readings on Zoom, and they're scheduled for the second Tuesday of the month at 7 o'clock.
So this is The Poet and the Poem on remote with Anne Bracken, and we are hypothetically at the Library of Congress. In spirit, we are. Let's have another poem, Anne. I know you have two books of poetry, and one is The Altar of Innocence, and I never make requests, but I do request one poem, and I forget the title, but it's about the nuns giving you lessons. Can you recall what that is?
Yes, it's a poem called, it's called Adultery.
How can I forget such a title?
Well, exactly.
Do you have to set us up with this, or are we going to understand it?
You'll understand, and all I'm going to say is it's about my first confession.
Whoa, we can't wait to hear your first confession. Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, Adultery. A room full of seven-year-olds are memorizing the Ten Commandments. They sit, eyes fixed, on illustrated poster-sized pages, bound with thou shalt's and thou shalt not's, printed in bold block letters. Sister speaks, and the class repeats. The sixth commandment is, thou shalt not commit adultery. The class echoes back as she rushes on, but in the space between, I raise my hand and ask, sister, what's adultery? Furiously flipping the page, she says, the seventh commandment is. My cheeks are burning. I study each word. Thou shalt not commit adultery. I struggle toward a solid conclusion. If adult means you're a grown-up, adultery must mean you're pretending to be a grown-up. A commandment just for children. With the realization of my frequent sinning, I begin examining my conscience. How often have I played dress-up or pretended to be a doctor, a nurse, a teacher? Mental tally held in my memory, I join my classmates filing into the church, lit solely by the red flame of the sanctuary candle burning for our sins. 42nd graders cram into four pews, silently waiting to seek forgiveness in the velvet-curtained confessional. The murmurs of transgressions like incense fill the air. I kneel, make the sign of the cross, and stammer, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. This is my first confession. And I have lied to my parents about 20 times, fought with my brothers and sisters about 17 times, and committed adultery 35 times. After a brief silence, punctuated by a sigh, Father Riley assigns me my penance, 2 Hail Marys and 1 Our Father, leaving me to believe in the truth of my innocence. He forgives me all my sins.
And I just could hear that over and over again, the innocence of the child. And that father must have been blown away.
Oh, I bet he was.
But, you know, you have Altar of Innocence, then would you say is all about your childhood? What other poems are in it?
Well, The Altar of Innocence is a memoir in verse about my growing up years and observing my mother struggle with severe depression and self-medicate with alcohol. And then the second part of the book is about my own journey through depression and recovery and getting out of a bad marriage.
Whoa. But to transform that into beauty is really kind of connected to the divine. To take that stuff, that matter, and change it to the light that's poetry is something I will never stop revering. Give us another poem or two from Altar of Innocence. Anne Bracken's here, and we're at the Library of Congress in uno senso, but we're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and here's Anne again.
Time travel. I want to go back to my mother, who wrote those desperate notes and left them on the kitchen table. Back to the woman who tried to quench her sacred thirst with ordinary gallo wine. I want to push all of her pill bottles off the counter and cheer as they crash. Then I will show her the dresses she designed, those watercolors from her lost self. Maybe I could even lead her up to the roof, where we would sit together, touching the green of trees. And Mom could see that anything is possible.
Sometimes our wounds serve us. Let's have another poem, Anne Bracken.
Okay, this poem is about a piece of my journey, and it's about the significance of getting a diagnosis, particularly a psychiatric diagnosis. The Hopkins doctor diagnoses me. The Hopkins psychiatrist asks me a question, then looks at my chart. I remember the first time and the second, when the depression lifted. I felt like a party girl. How long did that last? A couple of days, three maybe? That's a couple of days too long. You have all the signs of bipolar too. What's bipolar about feeling great for a few days after a year-long depression lifts? I list all the symptoms I don't have. No overspending, no sleeplessness, no promiscuous behavior. Without looking up at me, the Hopkins psychiatrist writes the new diagnosis in my chart. Months later, the depression lifts after 4 years, but the migraine rages on. My doctor loads me up with prednisone for 3 weeks. I hear the swishing of blood running through my veins. My thoughts fast-track through the looping tunnels of my mind. I've never been so out of control. The doctors decide it's time for mood regulators. I try to reason with them. The block letters on the prednisone label shout, "Mania can be a side effect of long-term use." Look at the side effects, I beg them. I've never been like this in my life, ever. I'm having a drug reaction, not a manic episode. But the Hopkins doctor put the diagnosis in my chart, and now I'm a patient locked in a psych ward.
You brought that home. You brought that poem home in a hurry. Anne is an activist. She is advocating for changes in mental health reforms and prison reforms. So it's very interesting that poetry can remain literature and not become PowerPoints. And Anne proves this with her poetry. Tell us, give us some background about your prison poems, Anne.
In 2015, the editor of the Little Patuxent Review met a woman who was running a writing program at Patuxent Institution in Jessup. And the editor wanted me to interview the professor. And I agreed to do that. And then I realized I also had to go into the prison, which I was very afraid to do. I just didn't know what to expect. And I'd had no experience. And I'd say I was full of all the typical prejudices that a lot of middle class people harbor. So when I went into the prison and met the men in the writing group, what I kept realizing and telling myself over and over was, they're not who you think they are. They're not the stereotypical people you might see in a movie or a TV show, and they're not thugs. A lot of them are people who've been abused in their own lives, or whose parents had drug and alcohol problems, or were unable to work for some reason, and they experienced some of the worst that life has to offer.
And from this, you were able to reach them with language, and tell us about how that happened.
They were some of the most curious people I've ever met. They were eager to learn all kinds of things. They wanted to learn history, and they wanted to learn forms of poetry. One day I just mentioned iambic pentameter, and one of the guys just couldn't wait to learn more about it. So they're not who you think they are. You know, they want to learn, they want to read, they want to grow. And I thought the best thing I could do with my experience was to write poetry that would share their stories with a larger audience.
What is the title of this manuscript, which will become book?
It's called The Prisons on Constitution Street.
And that must be an actual place.
It's an actual place in Baltimore, and there are several prisons on Constitution Street.
Several?
Yes, several, which I thought was really ironic. And it's in the same area as the City Hall and the police department.
Tell us from how you approached the group, your days and weeks of working with them has provided you some outcroppings of your own, and we'd like to hear that.
Do you want to hear a poem?
Sure. So give us a poem from your forthcoming book.
Okay. This one is based on a man that I met, and I found out that he had spent a lot of time in solitary. It's called J.C. Sits in Solitary. They tell me that beauty lives everywhere, but I've never seen it. They tell me that beauty contains alchemical properties capable of transforming a man's fortune. But I don't see beauty walking through this concrete abyss. No different from my old street with boarded up vacant homes, my old school with broken windows and metal detectors. Beauty would turn away from the routine of gray slop on metal trays. Meals shoved through a slot twice a day. Some days I remember how my parents raised me with hallelujah and go to school, while my minister charged me to love Jesus and throttle Satan. Now I sit with loss, my only task survival. The promise of beauty, another mirage on the mildewed concrete wall.
And how much of that was his actual speech?
It really wasn't his speech, but it was based on experiences that
he told
right,
you.
Right. Yes.
As hard as it was for you to endure, I think that what you've done must be heard by everyone. It changes people's minds. May we hear another poem from this prison experience?
Yes, I have one called Hope on Hold. Once you're inside, ignore the wreckage of time, the lined faces of men gray with age, the once slick 16-year-old, the disorganized shuffle of papers and rules and feet, the torpor of boredom thick as dreams of honey on toast, of aspen shade in June, of crinkling gift wrap. Once you're inside, every smile is suspect, every glance a risk. Even hope tucks into a corner when those doors groan closed.
Knocks you out, really. I hope that this is somehow received by legislators, because it has more felt life. I think it's more persuasive than an op-ed, because poetry is about experience, and you replicate the feelings, the taste, the sounds, and the heart of the experience. And I hope that somehow it morphs up to people who make decisions, and that's not impossible, Anne.
Well, that is my hope as well, because one of the things I learned when I was teaching writing in college was that the way that you get people to change their minds is not with facts.
Mm.
The way people change their minds is by connecting to a story.
That is, say that again, that is it.
Yeah, the way people change their minds is not with facts. You get them to change their minds when they connect with a story.
story. That's the way we know what we have in common. It's yes. really the way that yes. human people connect the dots.
Right.
Story. And it's making that's a these, good definition.
The poems are my attempt to really humanize a group of people that know that so many of us never ever have any contact with.
Do you think of them often?
Yes.
It's something that's
I was just going to say, I still have one friend from that experience, and he is a big success story. So that's very, it's not through anything I did. It's, you know, his journey was just inspiring, and he continues to inspire other people.
You're part of his journey, Anne. Oh,
yes.
Yes. I remember the many letters you wrote, and I did hear about his actually presenting poetry in public.
Yes.
So I think
yes.
you can take a hand in that. Let us go back to Altar of Innocence and hear another poem.
Okay. This one is called Mrs. S. No one ever tells the story of Mrs. Sisyphus. Perhaps because she endures at the bottom of the hill with all the little boulders tumbling from above. In between the spinning of cloth and the baking of bread, she rolls the children out the door to play and rolls the food home from the market. Day after day, she jostles the water jugs from well to house and back. She nudges and cajoles the bigger boulders of animals from pasture to barn and finally to slaughter, preparing feasts for all the baby Sisyphi who gather round the table whining, "When is Daddy coming home?"
Only a poet would take that point of view. That's why we need poetry more than ever before. And
that's
Anne
right.
Bracken, give us a final poem.
Okay, I'm going to read a poem that's called When I Think of My Father, and it was inspired by listening to Robert Hayden's poem, Those Winter Mornings, Those Winter Sundays. When I think of my father, it's as if my legs are pumping up and down, riding faster, back to all the mornings when Dad cooked breakfast for us in the yellow kitchen. I hear eggs sizzling in the cast iron skillet, smell SK bacon and Taylor's ham. I hear Dad ask, "Can I make you anything?" When I think of my father, the rub of regret wraps its hands around me as if to strangle my answer and offer a new scene where I slide the yogurt container back into the refrigerator and instead I say yes to the eggs fried in bacon grease, dotted with the bite of black pepper.
That is the voice of Anne Brackett. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, with additional support from the Sinipet Fund and the Maryland Humanities. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.